Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. In this hour, is it time for the United States to deploy ground troops in Iraq? Former U.S. envoy to Iraq Paul Bremer says yes, because it's the only way to save that country. He'll also respond to recent findings that his coalition provisional authority in 2003 and 2004 lost track of billions of dollars, some of which is now fueling ISIS. We'll hear from Paul Bremer in just a few minutes, but we begin with the ongoing effort to defeat ISIS in the Middle East. The terrorist organization that has now beheaded multiple hostages is holding at least 22 others from 12 countries and seems to be continually expanding its reach in Iraq and Syria. The U.S. effort so far to combat ISIS has been restricted to airstrikes in Iraq and Syria, and President Obama says he has no plans to deploy U.S. ground forces there beyond the up to 3,000 intelligence officers and advisors already in Iraq or on their way there, despite the fact that Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Martin Dempsey's suggestion that the recommendation for boots on the ground could be in the president's near future. Now, one person who is calling for U.S. troops, and this might not be a surprise to many of you, Ambassador Paul Bremer. Bremer was tapped by President George W. Bush as the presidential envoy to Iraq in 2003, and he ran Iraq during that period after the fall of Saddam Hussein as head of the Coalition Provisional Authority. Bremer's calling for another surge in Iraq and for the American military to do all that is necessary to defeat ISIS.
The president, I think, deserves credit for taking a tough decision, particularly given what his position had been when he agreed to reengage in Iraq in August. And he has correctly defined his objective, I think, which is to degrade and destroy ISIS. But so far, he hasn't put in place the tools needed to achieve that objective. And gradually, I think he's beginning to realize he's going to have to put more troops in. And the euphemism about boots on the ground and combat forces and so forth effectively is going to have to be put aside.
What's your understanding, having been in Iraq and operated there, about the function, the true function, the combat function, if you will, of U.S. advisors? Now, they don't all have the same job. Some are involved in intelligence. Some are involved in helping the Iraqi army select targets. Some are involved in advising. Some of those are euphemisms that I think ordinary people don't understand. And the question sort of goes to this point. If we're going to have 3,000 sets of boots in Iraq within the next month or two, what exactly is it that they are doing, if not pulling the trigger and aiming at ISIS fighters?
I think you passed over, mentioned several of the areas. One is certainly collecting and providing intelligence and doing the planning based on that intelligence. As this campaign develops away from its total reliance on air attacks, it's going to have to move to ground troops, which have to retake cities, Fallujah, Mosul, et cetera. The ground forces will need good intelligence for urban warfare. You need to know which building the bad guys are in. And for that, you need forward air observers, if you're going to call in airstrikes or drone strikes. You need planners who are going to figure out the best way to, say, retake a building that ISIS is occupying in, say, Mosul or Ramadi. For that kind of thing, you need forward people, Americans in the forward area, doing forward spotting, communicating back to the air forces, and helping plan. And that's the kind of operation that I think we're going to see. Whether you call those combat forces or forces with a combat mission, which is another of the euphemisms that the administration has used, is essentially a detail. They're going to be at risk. And I think most Americans would say, well, they're in combat. And they would be right.
You know, Ambassador Paul Bremer, the thing about this entire debate that strikes me that's so interesting and maybe so hard to get your head around is that the intellectual sort of basis of a new surge fighting ISIS over there is very similar to the one from 2003 after 9/11, which really is a doctrine of preemption. We have to go and confront ISIS now in the deserts of Iraq or Syria so that they don't harm us at home. And to a lot of Americans, as you know, that sounds eerily familiar to the justifications for the invasion in 2003, which American history has recorded, for better or for worse, as a big mistake.
Well, I would start by contesting your last statement. I think it's a little early for history to make any judgments. And I can make a counter-argument that it was not a big mistake, but that's perhaps for another discussion. Whether the situation mirrors or doesn't mirror some situation in the past is really not the question. The question is, what is the threat we face now? We now face one of the most extreme terrorist threats America has ever faced. A group of people, particularly with Americans among them, among the fighters, who could come back to the United States with their American passports and conduct attacks on the homeland. Those are facts.
Ambassador Paul Bremer was United States envoy in Baghdad in 2003 and 2004 at the dawn of the Iraq War. And Ambassador, we had Stuart Bowen on the show. He was the American lawyer who served as the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction up until October of 2013, detailing at least $10 billion that went missing of U.S. money. Now, I bring it up to you because Bowen made the point and made it very clearly that a lot of that money is what ISIS is living off of now. And our host, John Hockenberry, asked Bowen about your role and about the role of the U.S. envoy in Baghdad at the time. Listen.
In 2003, tens of billions of dollars in cash, both Iraqi and U.S. money, were transported to Iraq into effectively a war zone with not enough oversight, and too much of it went missing. When I met with Prime Minister Maliki a couple of years ago, partly to discuss this case, but also to discuss corruption, he pointed his finger at me and said, "You caused us to be corrupt by bringing all this cash and putting it in front of us without a coherent system. Theft, perfidy was inevitable."
Now, Ambassador Bremer, I'm going to let you answer, but listen to what Stuart Bowen said about your role.
Ambassador Bremer, who was the administrator of the Coalition Provisional Authority, really was asked to do an impossible task: rebuild a country that was collapsing. And perhaps we went too fast, with too much money, too soon, and as a result didn't accomplish enough, didn't meet our goals well enough, and a civil war, frankly, ensued.
Paul Bremer, Stuart Bowen said you were given an impossible task, but that nevertheless so much of that money has filtered through Iraqi corruption and feeds ISIS today.
Well, if you have a minute, I'd like to answer those accusations.
Please.
First of all, Mr. Bowen's assertion about money going missing is based on a report that some of his staffers wrote after spending fewer than 10 days in Iraq in the spring of 2004. What they looked into in terms of money was Iraqi money, not American money. These were not appropriated American funds. These were funds that belonged to the Iraqi government and which were used to pay Iraqi civil servants and to pay basically the government expenses, the Iraqi government expenses. His two staffers spent about 10 days in the offices of the Coalition Provisional Authority. They never visited any Iraqi ministries. They reported that while we could say which money went to which ministry, and the ministry could confirm they received the money, that the ministry, say the Ministry of Agriculture, could not account to the last dinar for the funds that were transferred to it. Well, this is perhaps correct, but you have to remember at that time, most Iraqi ministries had no computers, they had no modern accounting systems, they had no capacity to track funds down to the last provincial office. Bowen essentially proposed that we should not have spent this money. This was Iraqi money, well, not ours. We should have not had spent it, which would have meant not paying the civil servants, not paying for the importation of goods and services, until we had put in place a Western-style accounting system. That would have, I think, been a serious mistake. And I've told Mr. Bowen since then that I think that would have been an impossibility. Nobody in a responsible position would have said we shouldn't pay the Iraqi government until we had an internationally accountable system in place. So I think his report, which is the basis from which he has since made these accusations, is simply incorrect. and proposed a level of sophistication that was essentially impossible to put in place in Iraq in the short time we were there. I agree you could make the case that perhaps we should have stayed longer, that we should have waited, but we certainly could not simply not pay people in Iraq for 14 months or a year and put that in basically on hold until we had an internationally acceptable accounting system in the government. That's just simply not a realistic goal.
Before we let you go, Ambassador Paul Bremer, I want to bring it back to the current day and sort of take a step back from this conflict. You were involved, of course, so intimately in Iraq. You're advocating for more of a surge, greater U.S. involvement now in Iraq. What does it mean to ask the American people to sign up for hundreds, maybe thousands of more U.S. troops lost in Iraq after all those years of war and after all the controversy that ensued in the war that ousted Saddam Hussein in the aftermath?
Well, it's obviously not something anybody would propose, certainly I wouldn't, if I didn't believe it was important to American interests. That's what we're talking about here. And I think we need to recognize that the successes that were achieved between 2003 and 2009, you have to remember we defeated al-Qaeda in Iraq by the end of 2009. They were a defeated force. And I think we now, and because we made some mistakes, including pulling our troops out in 2011, we now are forced to go back in and defeat basically the son of al-Qaeda in Iraq called ISIS. It's not an easy decision or an easy recommendation to make, but the consequences for American interests of not doing it, I think, are even greater.
Ambassador Paul Bremer was head of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad from 2003 until 2004. Ambassador, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
Nice to be with you again.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In the aftermath of the death of Peter Kasich, the third American to be killed by the Islamic State, reports emerged this week that the Obama administration will conduct a full review of U.S. policy on negotiating with terrorists in hostage situations like Mr. Kasich's. And that review has actually been in the works since the summer. The review was disclosed in a letter from the Defense Department to Republican California Congressman Duncan Hunter, and it calls for specific emphasis, quote, on examining family engagement, intelligence collection, and diplomatic engagement policies, end quote. Now, you're thinking about one thing, which is ransom. Now, unlike some European governments, which have paid millions of dollars in ransom, the U.S. government has strict rules of not negotiating with captors and not paying. But that doesn't preclude private firms from negotiating on behalf of hostages with insurance. However, that's something the White House advises against.
Our views on this are clear, and the president continues to believe, as previous presidents have concluded, that it's not in the best interest of American citizens to pay ransoms to any organization, let alone a terrorist organization, that is holding an American hostage. And the reason for that is simple. We don't want to put other American citizens at even greater risk when they're around the globe.
White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest briefing reporters there on Tuesday. Joining me now to weigh in on the hopes for a revamped policy is Christopher Voss. He's a 24-year veteran of the FBI, where he served as lead international hostage negotiator. He's now CEO of the Black Swan Group, a negotiation advisory firm. Hi, Chris.
Hi. How are you, Todd?
I'm well, thanks. The White House, once this review was revealed, was quick to say that it does not include a revamp of the policy of no ransom. Is that a good thing?
It is a good thing. I mean, the issue really is whether or not they're going to use communication as a means to gather information.
What does that mean, use communications as a means to gather information?
Well, actually, you know, the policy is not that we won't negotiate with terrorists. The policy is that we won't make concessions to terrorists. And if you include the idea of communicating without making concessions, it speaks to your definition of negotiation. But you shouldn't be afraid to communicate with anybody. And sometimes a policy is misconstrued to make it sound as if we're afraid to talk to people. And sometimes it's enacted in that way also. The government acts like it's afraid to talk to people. We shouldn't be afraid to talk to anyone.
In the aftermath of some of the horrific beheadings that the nation has watched on YouTube, from ISIS in Iraq and Syria. There have been complaints from some of the families of the victims confronted with these tragedies saying that the U.S. government seemed concerned, sad, but that hostage situations were fairly routine. That was the family's assessment, that the U.S. government wasn't really serious or urgent about ending these situations because they didn't want to negotiate.
Well, that's an interesting interpretation of a lack of involvement by the U.S. government, and probably they had reason to feel like that the government wasn't particularly involved in helping them, because I don't think they've gotten a lot of help in the recent cases.
Meaning that the government was remote and feeling like its hands were tied, so the families felt like they were on their own?
Pretty much, yeah. I think the government recently has not known what to do, has not supported the families well. I don't think that they thought that if they can't mount a military strike immediately or conduct a rescue immediately, they see it very black and white, don't see any gray, and can't see a way how to help, how to try to engage in any sort of a communication process that might have other outcomes other than the payment of a ransom. So I think the families have not been supported well in the last cases.
I mentioned private insurance companies a minute ago. How do they complicate this process? Of course, you can imagine the State Department, the White House saying, you know, this really undermines our policy, insurance company, if you're negotiating for someone's release, since you're the one with the money, please don't do it. But they can't really stop them, or can they?
They probably could. They could probably threaten to prosecute them, and then families would who were going to pay ransom would find ways to pay ransom on their own. It's not really very helpful, and they can't stop the insurance companies from having consultants that support the families in other ways. It's kind of watching a robbery happen to someone, and these families are victims of crimes. It's not just their family members that are being killed, but the entire family is being victimized. And for the government to stand back and say, not only we're not going to help you, but we're not going to let anybody else help you either, is just not good for its citizens.
So, Christopher Voss, what needs to change now? If nobody's going to change the policy of not paying ransoms, which is understandable, what does the government need to be able to do differently next year, the next time one of these situations arises, versus the last terrible hostage situations that we've seen?
They need to not be afraid to open lines of communication. You shouldn't be afraid to communicate. Even if you don't like what the other side's saying, that communication process might support other outcomes.
Doesn't that often go on anyway? We saw the release of Bo Bergdahl a few months ago, which was controversial, but it was pretty clear that if the United States didn't negotiate directly with the Taliban, certainly intermediaries did negotiate. That must go on a lot.
That's a very good point. And there are always intermediaries that are engaged in these cases, trying to find other sorts of solutions, you know, some sort of a humanitarian option. There's always people that could use medical assistance. The Bo Bergdahl case is somewhat perplexing because no one, myself included, really understood the reasoning behind that or the rationale that was proposed and how that stacks up differently than these other cases. So, yeah, the Bergdahl case is an interesting case.
Christopher Voss is a veteran of the FBI. He served as lead international hostage negotiator. He's now CEO of the Black Swan Group. Mr. Voss, thanks.
My pleasure, Todd. Thanks for having me on.
Just two votes shy, a major bill that would overhaul the NSA's bulk data collection program failed to pass a cloture vote in the Senate last night and won't move forward for a debate this year. The bill has one of those euphemistic names, you know, the kind that really makes you suspicious about what's in it. This one's called the USA Freedom Act, and it would, among other things, curtail the government's bulk collection of metadata on communications made by persons in the United States. It's a program that first came to light largely because of the revelations of Edward Snowden. Well, last night's vote was a major blow for civil liberties groups, but a victory for our next guest. He's General Michael Hayden, former director of the National Security Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency. General Hayden, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks very much.
You called the NSA reform bill a bill that only ISIS could love. And in fact, a lot of the bill's opponents used your recent statements on the Senate floor to say that curtailing the NSA could give ISIS fighters a free hand in the United States. Is that overstating it?
Well, actually, the headline was not something that either Judge Mukasey, who co-authored the piece, or I wrote. That was a Wall Street Journal summary. But, God, I have to admit, it was a pretty accurate summary of what we were trying to say, if a bit overly dramatic. So let me put that on the record. What we were saying was that we want this very important legislation to be considered in regular order. The Freedom Act, the Leahy bill, had not gone through any committee markup or any committee hearings. This is a big deal, and this isn't a battle between light and darkness, good and evil. This is about balancing two things that are both goods, two virtues. We're trying to balance security and our liberty.
Well, the point of your editorial, and I read it closely, wasn't so much Senate process or regular order. It was really saying in many different facets of the Patriot Act in Section 215, which is what we're talking about here, that curtailing the ability of the government to have bulk collection would damage the government's ability to track terrorists, could result in attacks at home. All of those specters of potential violence were in there. It wasn't really about Senate process.
Well, no, actually it is, because what you just said is true. This will make it more difficult. It will be more cumbersome. It will be less agile. The question is that okay? And I mean that sincerely. I mean, free people decide this balance all the time. I think it's fair enough for people like me with my background to simply point out, no, this will not be as good in terms of defending the nation as the previous regime. Because, Todd, if it were as good, that's how we would have been doing it.
A lot of people who understand just the basics of this, General Hayden, say, well, bulk collection wouldn't really end. It would just live where it's always lived, at the phone companies. We all know that phone companies hang on to our records because they have phone records. We know that. All this would say is the NSA can't hang on to this stuff. It lives at the phone companies, and if the NSA needs to do one of its searches, which we all want it to do to protect us, go get a warrant and do the search.
Well, actually, the bill that Senator Leahy put on, would like to put on the floor, is broader than that. But let's just talk about the retention of metadata issue. NSA keeps the records right now for 5 years. Phone companies keep the records now for about 18 months. And so immediately you have a distinction as to the depth you can go when you have what we call a seed number. Now, Todd, this all begins with a number we have good reason to believe is terrorist-related. We simply want to know, has that number been in contact with any numbers inside the United States? Under the regime proposed by the Freedom Act, we get to ask that question 18 months backward. Under the current regime, we get to ask that question 5 years backwards. That's a difference. And then, before you ask the database that question about the seed number, the dirty number, as we call it, you now have to go to under the Freedom Act, to a FISA judge. And this is the really curious thing about the law. What exactly is it the FISA judge is verifying? He's actually verifying the intelligence analyst's conclusion that the foreign number he has in front of him is indeed related to international terrorism. That's not playing to the sweet spot of the American court system. They don't have expertise on that.
Well, Leahy's bill wouldn't send it to the American court system, of course. The FISA bill would exist, but there would be an advocate, I guess you could call it an adversarial advocate, so that instead of the government going before the court and saying, give us this warrant and getting it, there would be someone to argue for civil liberties to say, whoa, hang on, really want to grant that warrant.
So it really does go to the court system, because now you're saying before the intelligence agency attempts to perform its foreign intelligence function, an American court has to hear the case and grant it permission. And then, you know, when the FBI goes up on Tony Soprano to listen to the content of his phone calls, they don't have an adversarial process in front of the court. It's just the FBI in front of the judge. So why are we extending protections to foreign terrorists that we don't give to American citizens in criminal prosecutions?
Well, let's take a step back before I let you go, General Hayden. The Snowden revelations last summer changed, maybe not in principle, but certainly in fact, Americans' assessment, sort of the balance that you and I have been talking about, privacy versus security. Where do you think we stand now in Americans' understanding of security versus liberty, 13 years removed from the horrible attacks that everyone remembers, but new wars cropping up with new terrorists in the Middle East, but also a lot of public concern, a great deal of public concern over the power that the government has to surveil their activities, surveil their phone usage, if not their conversations?
And, Todd, that's a great question, and you're absolutely right. This gets us back to the fundamentals of the republic. This is Hamilton versus Jefferson, you know, and we just continue to replay that as the republic goes forward. And, hey, look, I share American constitutional values, too. The people at NSA are as much Americans as are the people who really oppose this kind of activity. And I understand the concern, not that this database has been abused, because there's no evidence of that, none whatsoever. I understand the concern that this database exists, that we, as Americans, inside our political culture, are uncomfortable with governments having the potential to misbehave. I get it entirely. I understand the concerns, but we also balance that concern. I need a government strong enough to keep me safe and not too powerful enough to threaten my liberties. Where is that line? Now, specifically, when the Snowden revelations rolled out 18 months ago, this was all about, oh, my God, my privacy. And Todd, to be very candid, given the events of the last 6 months or so, there's an awful lot of oh, my God-ing going on out there about our safety as we see the beheading of American citizens by a particularly pernicious terrorist group in the Middle East.
The specter of terrorist attacks and the specter of privacy violations, the age-old debate Hamilton versus Jefferson, but also a Senate debate, General Michael Hayden, former director of the National Security Agency and the CIA. We appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you.
This is a Global CalLink prepaid call from
Adnan Sayed.
Well, if you're like me and millions of other Americans, you can't wait for Thursday, tomorrow. Why? Because Thursday is the day that Serial comes out, and you can download it on your phone. Now, if you're not caught up, don't worry. No spoilers in the next 8 minutes. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, let me get you clued in. Serial is a new podcast that tells a true story over 12 episodes. This season, it's a crime story, a murder mystery, and a good old whodunit. Now, I got to admit, I'm obsessed, and I'm not alone. According to iTunes, Serial has been downloaded and streamed more than 5 million times, the fastest podcast ever to reach that level of popularity on iTunes. So just what has made Serial so successful, and how does it conform to and even break the conventions that have long made crime fiction so successful in novels and on television? Writer Megan Abbott is the author of several crime fiction novels herself, most of which are inspired by real-life cases. Her most recent novel is The Fever, and she joins me now. Hi, Megan.
Hi, happy to be here.
It's good to have you. And before you and I start, let me reprise just the very, very basics here of Serial. A true story. In 1999, high school senior Hailey was murdered in her senior year of high school in Baltimore County, Maryland. Her ex-boyfriend, Adnan Syed, was convicted of the murder. He has spent the last 15 years in jail. However, there are a lot of questions, open ends, and a lot of serious questions about this case. Therein lies our obsession as the hosts of Serial, Sarah Koenig, goes on to try to find out some of the holes in the case. So as someone, Megan, who consumes a lot of crime fiction and produces a lot of crime fiction and even sort of fact-based crime fiction, what do you make of Serial so far?
Well, I have to say I'm completely blown away by its popularity, this sort of surge in it. It was the first thing I read as a kid. It was sort of my Grimm's fairy tales was true crime. So I've been reading it my whole life and writing crime fiction for a long time now. And I listened to it because it was made for me in some way was quick to sort of jump on it. But I've never seen the response to it staggers me because usually it's sort of been my dirty secret. You know, you don't always tell people that you read or consume true crime because it's considered to some people unseemly. So to have it have this level of really prestige, all these stories written about it has been quite surprising.
Okay, but there's a but in your eyes. You yes. like it, but you're a professional.
Yes.
What's the but? Something bugs you.
I mean, I think that it has not reinvented the wheel or invented anything new. I think it's brought what's already been being done in true crime for decades, but it has this imprimatur of This American Life. So it's allowing people to access it that would normally maybe look down on true crime. So
So sort of the cultural kind of brand of our friends over at WBEZ in Chicago, This American Life, kind of making this accessible to smarty pants people who who don't buy their fiction on the grocery store checkout line.
That's right.
Right?
No, exactly. And I think that they, you know, it's sort of letting sort of the guilty pleasure. And I don't think there's anything to feel guilty about. It's a very well done show. I have some problems with its construction as a writer, its story construction, but it's very well done. In terms of the construction of the show, one of the things that's really interesting is the sort of unreliable emotional narrator that you have in Sarah Koenig, who is a character in her own right. In the podcast, you know, she's sort of bumbling through the case. We follow her thought patterns. That's really interesting.
Her frustrations, her excitement.
Exactly. The giddiness that most reporters would conceal when they finally wrote a piece. You know, that they're sort of the process is made laid bare here, which I think is really interesting. That's happened in journalism for a long time, since new journalism, since Joan Didion and Hunter S. Thompson. But in terms of story construction, there is a kind of sloppiness to it, perhaps by intent. There's things that clearly she knew at the beginning that she doesn't reveal till episode 6 or episode 7. But I don't think it's actually new. What might be new is the intimacy of its podcast format.
Well, and so – and that's – they're both part of what I want to talk to you about, construction and the podcast format, because – Serial does conform to some of the conventions of film noir. You go along with a narrator who's telling you about their next steps, what they were thinking. Ah, that doesn't rub me right, so I went to see this person. Not quite as dramatic as film noir in some ways, or at least a little more real. So they obey those conventions, right? Do they do that well?
Yes. I think it, the sort of reversals and misdirection, you know, each episode you might come out thinking that Anna is guilty or he's innocent. And the show expertly does that. Cliffhangers, sort of all the suspense that you would suspect. But this isn't film noir. It's not fiction. It's true. So it gets into a little bit of dicier terrain. I mean, these are real people that we're dealing with that, you know, with real lives. So a girl died, her family suffered. So in some ways, there's a risk of sensationalization as well.
And so somebody in your business, even though you write fictional novels, they are based on fact. You think that there is a risk by making a serial entertainment show out of a real crime with real people that it may be crossing an ethical line?
I certainly don't think that. I think, but it's certainly a question that I hope the show raises within itself at some point. And I think it's danced around that. I know there was a little bit of a brouhaha recently because the brother of the victim, or someone saying he's the brother of the victim, appeared on Reddit where they've been online where they've been investigating
right.
the case and said, you know, this is not a CSI. This is not a murder mystery. This is my family's life. My mother had a heart attack when she heard about her, you know, my sister's death. And to have your personal story blasted to 5 million listeners is you know, appalling. And I don't know if it's been proven that was actually identified as the actual brother, but it is something to think about that when you're a novelist, you don't have to worry about as much.
Sure. Megan Abbott, I have to ask you one thing. As a professional storyteller yourself and somebody who knows what it means to investigate a true fake crime, maybe. Does Sarah Koenig, does she have to solve it? Does she have to? Is there a point of all this if she doesn't crack the case?
Well, that's the question. Are you going to satisfy the listeners if you don't have the answer? When you write, you know, there's this great Raymond Chandler, the detective novelist, had this great phrase about the austere simplicity of fiction versus the tangled wolf of fact. And I think that's a problem when you're doing the real story. You can't invent anything. You can't satisfy or resolve something that isn't actually resolved. And so the problem of the ending, I think, is one they're fighting as they go here.
What happens if you get to the end and the conclusion is, yep, they got the right guy?
Or we'll never really know.
Until next season?
Indeed.
That's something you would do. Sell more books, right? More podcasts.
No, I got to give the readers what they want.
Megan Abbott is author of several crime fiction novels. Her most recent is The Fever, and she may not be an addict, but like me, she's a listener every week of Serial. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now we want to hear from you. We've been asking you all hour about what you look for on food labels.
Hi, my name's Sarah. I'm from Tampa, Florida. And I rely on food labels because in this day of processed food products, it's really important to know what's in my food and what I'm putting in my body.
We got this from Louisville, Kentucky. There should also be some truth in our labeling to define what is natural. So many things say natural flavor. Then you read the label and there's not a thing natural about it. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And I want to give a special thanks to our man, Rich Lamont, one of our board ops, moving on to another gig here at WNYC and leaving The Takeaway. Thanks, Rich. Thanks for being on the show. We appreciate it. You're the man. And thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.